Welcome to Emil Franzing's Voices of the West, dedicated to the principle that America was better off when our TV shows featured cowboys instead of lawyers.
Indeedy-do. Welcome to another edition of Emil Franzing's Voices of the West. I'm Harry Alexander, Bunker de France, and Todd Roberts with us today. And our guest is Bob Colby. We're going to be talking about pictures of the Dakotas.
The kind that don't move.
Yeah, right, the kind that don't move. But first, we do Bunkers.
Coming to you from Bunker's Bunkhouse is the good. The sound is my theme song. The good, the bad, and the bovine. And the way this works, Bob, just so you won't be too perplexed, is I start with today, which happens to be the 11th of this month, and I go back 3 days in time, and I go forward 3 days in time. But the 3 days in time forward are not really forward, they're backward, because I'm going back in time and going forward.
Sure.
But I'm going to start now with July 8, 1947. This is fairly recent. The Roswell, New Mexico Army Airfield issued a press release claiming a flying disc was recovered, sparking the enduring UFO phenomenon.
Huh.
I grew up over in that part of the country, and nobody in Roswell even cared until recent times. So that's spaceships under the bridge. Okay, July 9, 1951, and this is a friend of mine, and we've had him on the show, Danny Ohako. He was raised in Winslow, Arizona, of a Bass ranching family. Notable rodeo performance, former, rode barebacks, transitioned into film stunt work, author of a couple of books on rodeo and movies. He's now living up in Sedona, Arizona, as a realtor and a developer. Now, on July 10, 1889, we're moving back in time here. I get lost sometimes.
And really?
Buckskin Frank Leslie murdered his lover in a drunken rage. He murdered Tombstone sex worker Molly Edwards, a.k.a. Blonde Molly Williams, for whatever reason. It kind of tickled him. He thought it was funny. July 11, 1914, that's today, but in 1914, so I don't want you to get confused.
Okay.
This is for you too, Harry, by the way. 19-year-old Babe Ruth made his Major League Baseball debut as a pitcher for the Boston Red Sox, and he was a pretty good pitcher, too.
You know, and these guys today, you get a little thumb blister or something, and they're on the disabled list. Ruth was out there pitching 9 innings, and he'd go out to the bar after the ball game, drink up, and come back the next day and pitch another 9 innings.
It's like all the old boxers back then. That's how they trained in the saloons.
Exactly.
Anyhow,
I digress.
I like the digression. And by the way, anybody that wants to jump in on something on the topic here that'll enlighten us and bring us more knowledge is welcome. Now, on July 12, 1917, this is a little local history here for Arizona, the Bisbee deportation. Mm. It was an illegal kidnapping and deportation of around 1,300 striking mine workers, their supporters, and citizen bystanders by 2,000 members of a deputized posse. The action was orchestrated by Phelps Dodge, the major mining company in the area. July 13, 1787, I like this period in time, the Congress of the Confederation, it was part of the Continental Congress, but for a year there they had this one arm of it going on. Anyhow, they enacted the Northwest Ordinance, creating the Northwest Territory, the new nation's first organized incorporated territory between the British North America, which was now America, us, and the Great Lakes to the north, Ohio River to the south, Upper Mississippi River to the west, and Pennsylvania on the eastern boundary. And I will say this, this is just a footnote. the Ohio Valley and the Pennsylvanias and all of that, that was as wild as the Wild West, maybe even more so. And we're going to finish up now with July 14, 1901, a young lady. This is not her given name, Pancho Barnes. Pancho was a nickname she picked up in Mexico, and Barnes was a married name. She was born. Anyhow, she was an aviator and a movie stunt pilot, one of the first American women to establish a reputation and a business in the field of aviation. And she worked on that very first super epic aviation movie.
Which was?
Wings.
Yeah, well, 1920, that was, what, 29?
That was the Howard Hughes one.
No, Wings was not Howard Hughes.
Whatever it was. That's not a Western.
Los Angeles was Howard Hughes. That was 1927.
It was Wings then. It wasn't Howard Hughes.
Wings was Bill Wellman.
Wellman, that's the one, Wellman. Yeah. See, I got it right after all, with help from my cohorts in crime.
All righty.
Now let's just make life miserable for Bob.
Okay, welcome to Bob Colby. He's calling us in from calling in for us. You know, it's amazing. I used to make my living with this mouth.
It's my influence on you.
It has to be. Anywho, Bob's written this book. They captured the moment. Dakota photographers from 1853 to 1920. Historical reference book, and my goodness, Bob, how did you get involved in that?
Well, early on, I got involved by virtue of collecting some postcards, and these are these postcards got me going. They were a set of five taken on the Texas-Mexican border during the Revolution, the Mexican Revolution, mm-hmm. And there was. As I said, a set of five. One showed the guys lined up in front of the firing squad. The second postcard shows them getting shot and they're starting to lurch. The third one shows them laying on the ground. The fourth one shows the coroner going over and saying, "He's dead, he's dead, he's dead, he's dead." And the fifth one showed a body that had been dragged. You know, I don't know if he was alive when they started or not, but he was pretty sad shape in the end. And I saw those, and they kind of captured my imagination. But the South Dakota National Guard was called up to go down to the border there. And I thought, oh, that's something I didn't know. And so I thought, I got to keep these, and one thing led to two, and finally I was picking up a lot of images, and finally I said, there's getting too damn many of them, so I have to narrow the field, and I said I'd get things, or try to get things that were Dakota Territory, North and South Dakota, and maybe just a little periphery around, because, you know, the history doesn't stop at the border.
Right.
And so far, I've been working at it, and in the course of time, I've picked up the real photo postcards and cabinet cards and CDVs and large formats and any kind of photography that generally goes before 1960, let's say.
Wow.
And I'm up around 45,000 images.
So were the photo postcards that you found originally, were those daguerreotypes or silver plates?
Yeah, these would have been produced. Daguerreotypes started in like 1840s.
Right.
So that, you know, this would have been substantially later. They went to daguerreotype, amber type, and then tin types.
Okay.
And then they went to the glass plate.
Right.
And then after that, they kind of generated into the film, roll film, and so that's the what I call the historic era, mm-hmm. because there aren't too many photos of Dakota Territory or South Dakota that are daguerreotypes or ambrotypes. Mm-hmm. There are a few tin types and that sort of thing, but the reason that I picked the dates for the book with a friend of mine, he was a lieutenant colonel in the South Dakota Air National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Beatty was his name, and we worked on that for the better part of 20 years, picking up material, and finally got to the point and said, you know, we ought to publish this because we got a lot of information nobody's ever seen before.
Wow.
So in 2006, we put the book out, and I'm in the process of doing a second edition.
Mm-hmm.
In the first edition, we did photos, about 100 photos, because people aren't going to buy the information that has the photographer's name, the place of operation, and the date. That's kind of bland. I mean,
sure.
Unless you're really diehard and interesting, right. You're interested in it. So they buy the photos, and that's what sells the book. And then afterwards they say, damn, there's a lot of good information here. So working on a second, though, I didn't mention that there were roughly 1,700 different photographers.
Wow.
In that time period.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And
wow.
I'm doing a second, working on the second edition, and hope to add about another 300.
Hmm.
So that'll put us right around 2,000. And one of my cohorts said, damn, no wonder none of them made any money. Too many.
Yeah. You are a historian. Are you also a photographer?
For S&G, I take photos and myself.
Okay.
And try to record stuff. But I don't do it as a profession.
Okay.
I have contributed photos to a lot of the local history books and that sort of thing. And currently working on a volume one and a volume two related to Dakota territory. The Black Hills Gold Rush took place right in 1874. And that's when Custer went out there and...
Mm-hmm.
And they found some gold. Well, it wasn't that they found the gold. It's they knew it was already there because a guy by the name of G.K. Warren had gone through and he'd gotten some samples along the way and made a report to the government because it was a government expedition.
Uh-huh.
And he made the report and said there was gold. And so they went out there ostensibly... because the travelers going from the east to the west on the Platte River Road were possibly being harassed by Native Americans because they were going in places they weren't supposed to be.
Oh, geez.
On a reservation. Yeah.
Yeah. So what happens, Custer and the boys, well, it goes back to Grant, U.S.
Mm-hmm.
president. There was a national depression in 1873. And what do you do to get a country out of the downturn?
Mm-hmm.
So he let the guys go, and Custer lobbied to get out there to do setting up a fort in the Black Hills to protect the travelers going from Omaha to Salt Lake City and out to California.
Mm-hmm.
So they went out to the Black Hills. Well, the closest that this expedition got to the Platte River was 150 miles. You know, that's a quick response in case you need to go on off and chase Indians.
Sure thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
2 days
ago. What about
a
bartender, Bob?
Were, 2 days ago, they were chasing them, and it'd take us 2 days to get there, and we'll catch them in the act, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Bob, I was looking up some stuff about you, and I came across something about where you were. You were born and raised on a farm near Sleepy Eye, Minnesota, and I just love that name, which I found out it was named from Sleepy Eye Lake, which was named after a chief, Sleepy Eye. Do you know any stories about him? Because that's such a neat name for a place, Sleepy Eye.
Yeah. He was in Dakota. He was I can't remember if he was a Sisseton. You see, the Sioux are broken up into several different. There's mm-hmm. Dakota, and then they have subsets beside that. And Sleepy Eye,
Yankton.
It was Ishtataba, and he got to meet, I think, President Monroe.
Wow.
And out east, and he came back, and he was a prominent person in the area, but he was never involved in any of the hostilities because he was too early, and he died before any of that took place.
Missed all the fun. Lake,
yeah, is it quite a? It's a nice little, I guess it's a glacial remnant lake.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a large chunk of ice stayed there longer than the glacier did, and when everything else melted, it was there. It's a pretty little place to be, and Sleepy Eye is. Well, they were known for a milling company. If you're into antiques and collecting,
mm-hmm.
they gave away premiums. And people all over the country collect those premiums. Some of them are pasteboard, some of them are little whatnots. And they used to have a set of pitchers, it went everything from a little cream pitcher for your coffee to a large 1 gallon pitcher, five sizes, and people around the country collect them. So that's a part of the reason that the name gets known around the world. But people get enamored with just the name Sleepy Eye.
Mm.
And the reason he got that name is he had droopy eyelids. And some of us who've gone through blepharoscopy, that's where the the eyelid hangs a little lower than it does in some people,
right.
And that's what he had, and that's why he was sleepy eyes, and the rest is history.
How cool. We got to do our first commercial break here on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, Todd Roberts with you, our guest Bob Colby, and he's an historian and doing all kinds of cool things, photographs of the Dakotas. We'll be right back.
Arizona, the land of cattle, copper, and cowboys. It's also the true West, where a large number of Westerns were filmed. For your next vacation, come out to where Wyatt Earp made a name for himself as a highly respected sheriff. Stay where Jimmy Stewart filmed Winchester 73.
That would be the White Stallion Ranch. Situated in the mountains just northwest of Tucson, the White Stallion Ranch is an award-winning dude ranch with 43 guest rooms and the Hacienda. That's a 5-bedroom, 3-bathroom home, perfect for larger families, family reunions, and girlfriend getaways. Every guest room has a private patio with views of the cactus gardens, mountains, or corrals. Generous floor plans offer sunny, comfortable rooms. But you won't want to stay in your room. Outdoor activities are plentiful at the White Stallion Ranch. Horseback riding, hiking, shooting, archery, rock climbing, e-biking, and a weekly ranch rodeo are among the numerous activities that you'll enjoy on your ranch vacation. Go Western for your next getaway. The White Stallion Ranch. Book your vacation now online at whitestallionranch.com or call 520-297-0252.
This is Eb Wilkinson at Wilkinson Wealth Management. If you're within 10 to 15 years of retirement and you're putting off retirement planning, my advice to you is don't do that. Ignoring your retirement planning won't make it go away. It'll just make it worse. Give me a call and let's work on your plan together so you can retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
The Tucson Trap and Ski Club is one of the best-kept economic secrets in town. This 900-member group maintains one of the finest shotgun shooting ranges in the country, featuring trap, skeet, five-stand, and sporting clays fields, and hosts national and international events that bring thousands of people and millions of dollars into our community. The Spring Satellite Grand American Tournament alone involves 1,200 participants for 10 days. Learn more about this and their other contributions to our community at TucsonTrapAndSkeet.com.
You out there! Come one step near and old Bess here will spit right in your eye.
Hi, Kate. Take it easy, it's me.
That'll teach you to talk back to a lady. And the next time you come pestering around here, remember, Ann Oakley and me went to the same finishing school.
This is the Voices of the West.
Back on Emil Franzi's Voices in the West. Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, Todd Roberts with you. Our guest, Bob Colby, his book, They Captured the Moment, Dakota's Photographers, 1853 to the 1920s. Pretty good stuff. Yes. Early photography. You know, we don't see a whole lot of images from back yonder. We do see images, but many times they are repeat images that we've seen printed elsewhere. Times, yeah. Todd Roberts, get in there.
So, Bob, when you're going through these photos over this period of time in this arc to put this book together, what was the photo that either surprised you the most, or the one that, shall I say, dispelled something that was not a truth about the West, which you've always heard, or we've always heard, and you go, wait a minute, that's not how it worked.
I'm a proselytizer for image storing in archives, etc., because with AI and with Photoshop, you can have Donald Trump shaking hands with George Armstrong Custer in front of the Alamo.
Well, they did, didn't they?
Yeah, well, okay. But, you know, it's, yeah, so the photography, one of the more recent ones that I got, it's what they call an imperial, and it's like a cabinet card, only it's horizontal, a little more panorama. And you look at it, and, okay, so you see the original log cabin, which is pretty sparse, and then there's a little shed next to it for keeping the horse. Then you can see the next rendition of a log cabin, which was a little bigger and better and nicer. And in the background is a log barn, which has something that I hadn't seen before. They used the long logs, and the barn was probably 40 foot long. And about 8.5 to 9 feet above the ground level, you can see butt ends of logs coming through the top, and then there's about 2 or 3 feet above that, and then you have the slope of the roof. Well, they had a loft. And I had never seen a log barn with a loft, you know, for putting hay and stuff like that. And then that was, and the people's, okay, then you're going over and you see the new cut lumber house, you know. They'd taken it to a sawmill, and this was flat cut lumber, you know, and it had shutters and it had drapes on it, and the people were all in front of a house, and there were 5 or 6 people on the left and 5 or 6 people on the right, and in the middle was this short person. Well, she was about 35, it looks like, and she would have been what is correct today to say a little person. And I've never heard of a, back in the day they would have called them midgets and dwarfs,
right?
But in Dakota Territory, she was the photographer's era of operation was 1885 to 1890. And so I'm trying to find out who that person is, because if I get her name, I can get more information about the rest of the stuff, because I know where she belongs. Mm-hmm. So you can research all of the other people.
Sure.
But, you know, it's just, you know, it was unusual because of the barn and because of the little person. Now, that's one of those things that you kind of go, oh. And I was fortunate enough to pick up a bunch of the CDVs, which is carte de visite, which are the little, they're almost like business card size, years ago, and it had a lot of the participants in the Sioux Uprising or Little Crow's War in 1862. And that's kind of neat to find and have.
Yeah.
Because all of the photos that I deal with are a window to a time period.
Sure.
Yeah. From the early settlement up until about World War II.
Hmm.
And then after that, everything is more modern, and we can identify it. You know, we've got drive-ins and hotels and motels and things of that nature. But this gives us a view of what our, my parents did a honeymoon at 39, so this would be what my parents saw when they were young and my grandparents lived through.
Yeah, yeah. That's that. That. Wait a second, Bunker. You mess with your cable there. Your microphone's not working. That's your headphone. Mess with the microphone cable. The back of the microphone.
Oh, here.
There you go. Now you're working.
Oh, okay. Anyhow, you were speaking about family, and I understand your father and grandfather were local historians, so I guess you got the bug from them, or you got any stories about them?
Well, my grandfather ran away from home, and he went out to Montana, and he was working out there, and he was a part of the 3rd Montana National Guard as a young guy. And then he heard about the earthquake and all that stuff in California, so he hitchhiked out to California, looked at it, came back to Minnesota, married my grandmother in 1908, and proceeded to have family. And he picked up stuff. He picked up Indian artifacts and one thing and another. My father was not only was he a gun collector, but he had an FFL, Federal Firearms License. And mm-hmm. when I was about a senior in high school, I started counting the guns, the weapons that he had accumulated, not the new stuff that he had for sale. And he had 300, and his.
Oh my!
That's when I quit. He specialized in Civil War carbines and lever action Winchesters.
Oh, wow.
I know a little bit about them. And when I see part of your advertisement was doing trap shooting and that sort of thing. And when I was in college, I did an OEO project and built a trap range. And I like guns, but I never was in that enthusiastic. I had a Model 31 Remington that my father had sold to a guy, and he went out hunting, and he got some snow in the end of the barrel, and he saw something to shoot, and it had frozen. And well, anyhow, I had, by the time we got done, the barrel length was 18 3/4 inches long.
Okay.
It opened up quick when you shot.
I reckon so. Mm. How many guns do you have, Bob?
I've had about 24. I mean, I've picked up some interesting things along the way, but one thing you learn, you never compete with your father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
But the interesting thing was he used to have a den in our house, the farmhouse, and there were some nights he'd have 3 or 4 different guys there with he talking about hunting and stuff like that, you know.
That's neat.
Bar stories, that's what they would be called today. And we kids learned if we kept our mouth shut, we could be there till past midnight. As soon as we started to add to the conversation, it was time for bed.
No, that's so cool.
Go ahead, Bunker.
Oh, I was just saying that's so cool. Oh, I just want to deal a little more with you. I understand you have an MNS in biology, which is, I guess, is a complex system of classifying bud. You went from that to teaching to clockworking and antiques. How did you go from analyzing blood to collecting pictures? I mean, that's quite a jump.
Well, part of it was getting married. Anyhow, my wife had a degree. She had her master's degree and got her doctorate degree in library science. Mm-hmm. And she worked for the University of South Dakota and in their library. And the head librarian there was a historian. And he had the opportunity to buy, it's Bodmer's artistic folio book. And have to describe it. It's probably 2.5 feet tall and is probably 18 inches or more wide. And when you open it up, that's where the pages were that Bodmer, the artist, painted views from Max Milliam's expedition up the Missouri River in the 1830s. And he acquired that for the library collection while my wife was there. And it's kind of fascinating to be able to look at the images that he did of buffalo hunting and of tribal areas where the teepees were set up, or mm-hmm. or the dancers, you know, in full regalia, and know that he had done the sketches in the early 1830s and completed this by about 1835, and you're standing there and you're looking at it, so you're really looking back at, well, that's just about 200 years ago, and you're saying, you know, that's kind of cool, kind of neat. So that's where she started with that, and then she could get a job with it. She was in a university library situations or college libraries. I figured wherever she can go, I can go. So, and one thing led to two, and I got a few teaching jobs, and I was trying to get into the local school system, and I thought, well, I can't just sit here and wait for the next year for the job market to open up. So I opened up an antique, and I did furniture refinishing, and then I did clock repair, and it's like they say, you know, the rest is history. That was 1972, so I've been doing that off and on, since 1972.
All right.
And in the interim, I ran for and was elected to the county commission 5 times, so I did my political service, and I've had a few extra experiences that, you know, some people don't always have the opportunity to do.
Hard to keep a job then, huh?
I just can't find somebody that likes me.
And cleaning those blackboards gets real monotonous.
Yeah, for sure. We got to do our next commercial break. Excuse me, here on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Bob Colby is our guest. Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, Todd Roberts with you. We're talking about They Capture the Moments, old-time photography. We'll be right back.
Can you even imagine switching back to pen and paper to run your business? Every year, we become more and more dependent upon our technology. If your network is not set up properly, you're just one click or one email away from losing data critical to your operation. Arizona Computer Guru offers a host of services to prevent and protect you from disaster. From online backup services to email filtering to fully managed network services, Arizona Computer Guru is here to keep your network secure, your data safe, and your budget in the black. To schedule your free consultation, call 304-8300.
This is Eb Wilkinson at Wilkinson Wealth Management. If you're within 10 to 15 years of retirement and you're putting off retirement planning, my advice to you is don't do that. Ignoring your retirement planning won't make it go away. It'll just make it worse. Give me a call and let's work on your plan together so you can retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
The Tucson Trap and Ski Club dates from 1948 and is now at 7800 West Ol Ajo Highway. The club owns 80 acres and leases 300 more from Pima County that supports 50 trap fields, 15 skeet fields, 2 5-stand fields, 2 sporting plays courses with 12 stations each, a 9,000-square-foot clubhouse, 200 full-service RV hookups for members, and free Wi-Fi. This expansive facility gives enough room to host major national and international events annually, bringing thousands of people to the community. Check it out at TucsonTrapAndSki.com.
She must be kind of desperate, Kitty.
Well, she's in an age where most women get kind of desperate.
Mm-hmm.
She knows he's broke and that he doesn't work much, but they're planning on getting married as soon as he can get some money together.
Well, she's safe then.
This is the Voices of the West.
Back on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West, Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, Todd Roberts in Los Angeles, our guest, from South Dakota, Bob Colby, and we're talking about old-time photos. And Bob, I got to tell you, I have to play this theme from the High Chaparral, otherwise De France Walks.
That's right.
He was in 52-3 episodes of that great television program.
And there's no postcards of me.
No. Well, that's because Bunker never looked at the camera. That's why.
Yeah, you got to be. You want to keep working. You got to be sneaky.
One of my relatives was down in Arizona, and he had the Rail X Ranch down around Tucson, and they did the movie Broken Lance on his Rail X Ranch.
Oh, that's a good movie. Yeah. That was shot down there by the Empire Ranch in the Circle Z down by Patagonia.
Yep. And so I had, our family doesn't have a lot of members, you know, with the Colby name. So we kind of do maintenance, but we don't grow. And we've had some of the clan have made a name for themselves. You know, one of them got to be Saint Maximilian Colby, and he's beatified by the Pope about 10 years ago.
Hey.
Martin Luther's grandchildren were Colbys. His daughter married a Colby. So, and there are a few others that I could mention. They keep their, they get their nose in places that maybe a lot of people wouldn't put their nose.
That's good. Yeah. Todd, get in there.
So, you know, Bob, that it's really, there's two, I have two questions for you. One is just a side question that really intrigues me, is the photograph of your father with that huge buffalo skull. If you tell us that story, because it's large, it's larger than normal buffalo sized skull. And the second question I have is, you go to the buffalo skull and then we'll go to the second part.
Well, one of our local friends, one of my dad's friends, he had a farm southwest of Sleepy Eye, and he had an area fenced in, you know, 20, 30 acres, and he had a bunch of buffalo in there, somebody asked him, how come his fence was like that? He says, don't they want, he says, can't they get out? He says, they can get out if they want to, and they never did. Well, that's not true. One day, the spring winds came up, and the wind was the right direction, and it was blowing, and the buffalo had the urge, and they went through the fence. And this was in the spring, of course. Well, nobody's going to go on out and round them up, and they didn't have anybody who had a lot of horses and all kinds of stuff like that. So they knew that when the buffalo were running, they'd stop, and then one of them would take the lead. Well, they'd all follow that leader. Well, it's the way the old buffalo hunters did, that that's why they could shoot 30, 40 buffalo at a time. They'd shoot the leader, the one that started the movement. Well, then they seemed like they had to stop and take an election. Well, and that's when they'd go on out and they'd shoot that one. Well, then they had to take another election. So they were, you know, they could have a pile of them there that they could, you know, they could skin out and do all that stuff, and they didn't have to chase them all over the prairie. Well, the same thing held true, and my dad was with his buddies, and my dad, being a gunman, he took a 44-40 lever-action Winchester. He says, I'm going to take a gun, and I get a shot. He says, I'm going to do it the old way. So they went down, and they got around the buffalo, and one guy says, okay, if they go to the left, I shoot. They go to the right, you shoot. Well, so my dad had read enough stuff about the buffalo hunters, so he knew that he shot just, you know, back behind the ear and a little low, because the spine came off low and then it went up to the top of the head. So it took off to the right. He dropped to a knee and he let one go and he shot it right behind the jawbone, between the jawbone and the ear, and he hit the spine. It went down like a lead balloon.
Wow.
And he got to keep the, I don't know if he got the cape, but he got the head, and he had that mounted, and that was in our den.
Yeah, that would work at a convention. Maybe we should
Yeah. Was that, did he have a scope or was he using iron sights?
Yes, open sights.
Okay.
Yeah, it was the old period.
Old time, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd drop on a knee and take a shot, and he was a good shot.
Yeah.
He did shot trap and that sort of thing. And
wow.
And I should mention that with that 31 Remington, I shot one set with that, and that was that 18 3/4 inch barrel. I got 23 out of 25, but I was bouncing shot off of the roof of the trap house.
That's pretty good shooting.
You say shoot and pull. Or you'd say pull, and you shot right away because you didn't want them suckers getting out there. I had a Model 12 Winchester with a full choke, and you had to let them go halfway down the football field before you take a poke at them.
How do you cook those things after you bag them?
Carefully.
Yeah, very carefully, yeah.
Tenderize them first, yeah.
Very carefully. Todd, you had another question?
My other question is, Bob, I've always heard this. I heard it in school. In college, and I've even read a paper on it, but I've never owned a clock shop, and I never knew anybody who owned a clock shop. But there's a theory that in a clock shop, if 4% of the clocks in that shop get in unison back in, in timing wise, that it can. They can overtake the entire shop or the majority of that. What is your experience with that, or you think I've been drinking too much bourbon?
Yes.
We always know that.
No. Bourbon, you got to have scotch. That's good stuff. Anyhow, you only have the ones running that you're working with at the time, and if they were, I never had more than four running at a time, but there might have been an alarm clock or two in there that you were working on or something else. But I never had anything. I never heard anything happen in my shop during the day when I was there, or even if I was there late at night, unless it was a holler or a scream. Because before I went in there, they used it as a karate club met there, and you'd occasionally hear some kind of a strange noise, like somebody
G.I.
looking to take a whack on somebody else.
But, mm-hmm.
That was when they hit a board and they hit it wrong and they broke their hand.
You would hear, some of them I thought were OS and some I thought were OF, but I couldn't differentiate,
I was looking again on some of this stuff here, and you were involved with a couple of books where the Sioux River Bends by Wayne Fainbuck. What was your involvement there?
Well, he was a friend of mine. He is still. I saw him the other day at one of the museum directors retired. And he was enamored with the history of Sioux Falls that people hadn't done. So he did a lot of research on the growth of Sioux Falls as information he got from the newspaper. But he was looking for a title, and being the guy I am, I suggested one, and that's the title of the book, Where the Sioux River Bends.
Oh. Did you have any pictures in there? Because I saw some pictures there of the river then and now.
Yep. I think almost all the illustrations, the photographic illustrations that were there, I had lent to him for use there. I've done that with a few other publications because it hits the time frame. There was the quartzite border up on the border between North and South Dakota. The markers were cut from stone in South Dakota, and they put them, I think it was every mile or every half mile on the state's border, differentiating North Dakota from South Dakota. And yeah, there's been a few others that I've done that way, and it's been gratifying to help somebody out, because a lot of things that people have in archives are the most highly commercial material, and the somewhat amateur or the local photographer, let's say that, or the amateur photographer. A lot of the postcards, that real photo postcards of anywhere in the United States, a good percentage of those were done by the amateur who had a camera, and they would take and make, you know, maybe a couple dozen images. Well, by this time in history, if any of them survive, they're probably unique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's another book, Minnehaha County Historical and Biographical Sketches Honoring the Centennial. I'm assuming you probably did, again, pictures and stuff for that.
Yeah, you know, I did. I think all the photos in there are pretty much mine, and I was the president, and I did the editorial part of it. They had a publishing company, and I just had to marshal the troops to make sure everything happened at the right time and the right place, and you know, give some. The editorial part would have been the captions that I gave the photos, because you don't correct some of the people's biographies that they submit. Mm-hmm. You know, you just. You don't touch what ain't broke.
Todd sent us a bunch of pictures to use for whatever, and I used one of them in our promotion on Instagram for the show. And one of the images that he sent, well, there were two images of one was a regular old camera, and the other looked like a stereo camera.
Yes, yes.
Do you own those?
Yes, yes. Wow. The stereo camera, you know, people say, you know, how does that work? The simplified explanation is, you know, eyes are about 2 to 2.5 inches apart, center to center. Mm-hmm. And the camera does the same thing. It has two lenses that are that far apart, and you take two different photos. If you look at a stereo view, and you look carefully, you can see that each one is slightly different. I mean, you got the same image, but you can see a little more on the left of one side of a person standing, or a little bit more on the right side. And when you publish them and put them on the card, and you look through the stereoscope, your brain collates the two separate images and gives you that field of depth. And a good stereo photographer will have something in the foreground, something in the middle, and something in the distance, so you get that wash away from you, that you're looking off into the distance, and it feels like you can reach out and want to touch something.
Yeah, it looks almost like 3D.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah, and most incredible.
You know, I've got it home. I've got this box, I don't know what you call it. It's like a disc. With it, you know, you put it in the little machine and you click it and it moves around, but it's a stereoscopic and it's all old-timey pictures. Do you have any of those things, like those discs? You know what I'm talking about?
For the Viewmasters.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I grew up on Viewmasters, you know.
Yeah, me too.
We had the little plastic holder with the two optics that came back to your eyes, and then the front was flat, and you saw the colored images. They're neat, and even those are collectible today, because they were photos taken. If they were taken in the 1950s and 1960s, I hate to tell you folks, but that's a half century ago.
Yeah, I know.
Well, the ones I've got are older than that.
Yeah, we try and forget that it's a half a century ago.
We were all kids then.
I know. We got to take our last commercial break here on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, and Todd Roberts with you. Our guest, Bob Colby. His book, They Captured the Moments. It's all about old-time photography. We'll be right back.
Arizona, the land of cattle, copper, and cowboys. It's also the true West, where a large number of Westerns were filmed. For your next vacation, come out to where Wyatt Earp made a name for himself as a highly respected sheriff. Stay where Jimmy Stewart filmed Winchester 73.
That would be the White Stallion Ranch. Situated in the mountains just northwest of Tucson, the White Stallion Ranch is an award-winning dude ranch with 43 guest rooms and the Hacienda. That's a 5-bedroom, 3-bathroom home, perfect for larger families, family reunions, and girlfriend getaways. Every guest room has a private patio with views of the cactus gardens, mountains, or corrals. Generous floor plans offer sunny, comfortable rooms, but you won't want to stay in your room. Outdoor activities are plentiful at the White Stallion Ranch. Horseback riding, hiking, shooting, archery, rock climbing, e-biking, and a weekly ranch rodeo are among the numerous activities that you'll enjoy on your ranch vacation. Go Western for your next getaway. The White Stallion Ranch. Book your vacation now online at whitestallionranch.com or call 520-297-0252.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. When people turn 50, something miraculous happens. They start to get serious about retirement planning. They've done very well so far and want to be certain they power into the retirement they've earned. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red.
No doubt you've heard about rescue groups for dogs and cats, but did you know there's a rescue group for horses? That's right, it's called Horse It Around Rescue. Founders Steve Boyce and Teresa Worrell are helping out all those equine victims of neglect and cruelty by giving them a place to restore their health and wellness. And Horse It Around provides a nurturing and natural environment where horses can be horses, so they can be adopted out into forever homes. More than 120 horses, mules, and donkeys have been adopted out, but like everything else, it costs money to run the project. Horse It Around is a 501c3 nonprofit located in Southeast Arizona. Your tax-deductible donations to Horse It Around will go a long way so those horses can be horses. Check out the website, horseitaroundrescue.org. Make a difference in a horse's life. That's horseitaroundrescue.org.
Besides bringing millions a year into this community with national and international events, the Tucson Trap and Skeet Club at 7800 West Old Ajo Highway services the local shooting sports community with a 380-acre site featuring trap, skeet, five stand, and two sporting clays fields, as well as a 9,000-square-foot clubhouse, which all is available to local shooters, and soon, an archery range. Check it out at TucsonTrapAndSkeet.com or take a drive out west of town and see it for yourself. New members or single-day use, welcome.
Billy. Got a little present for you. A 25-cent piece I plugged at 20 yards.
I got a little present for you, Pat. A nickel plugged at 30 yards.
Now I've got to go out and ruin a nice, new, shiny 10-cent piece. Good night, everybody.
This is the Voices of the West.
Texas packed up and left this morning. I don't know where she's gone, and most of all, I don't know why. I only know I've got the blues. I've never been this lonesome. It's enough to make a man lay down and die. Lone Star Beer and Bob Wills Music.
We are back on Emil Franzi's Voices of the West. The great Red Steagall there. And I remember playing this when I was in country radio, man.
I remember drinking Lone Star
Beer. Yeah, I remember drinking Lone Star Beer, too. Harry Alexander, Bunker to France, Todd Roberts with you on our program. Our guest is Bob Colby. He's got a book out, They Captured the Moments. It's about old-time photography in the Dakotas from 1853 to the 1920s. Let's see, we're about at the...
You're at that time.
We're almost at that time for... Well, actually, we are at that time, Bob, for some shameless promotion.
Okay, shameless. I said I'm doing two volumes right now on the Black Hills Gold Rush. One will be the biographies of the 20-plus photographers who were there between 1874 and 1879. There are some real stories there, The second volume is going to be stereo views and maybe some other views that were done between 74 and 79 with captions. So I figured that's too much of a load for one book, and we'll do two and see what happens.
There you go.
The photographers, you know, we have biographies of a lot of different occupations, but you know, in doing these, I've been working on some of these guys for a while and trying to polish them a little bit. The one I've told a lot about recently was a photographer. He was at Fort Randall on the Missouri River and taking photos and being the Fort Sutler. And across the river was a place that sometimes it was off limits to the fort because it had a stage stop, a store, it had the whorehouse and a couple other buildings.
Oh, no.
And and he got enamored with a girl over there, and he married her. Yeah. He was only 20 years older than she was.
Okay.
And I still don't know if it was he asked her or if it was they better get that done. Because
shotgun.
Shotgun wedding.
Yeah, there you go.
They went off to see his folks in northern Missouri, did that. A couple of years later, she divorced him. He never married again.
Wow.
He did some settling over in northern Nebraska in a town called Irwin. It's on the map, and that's about as big as it was. I don't think it had. It was a bunch of people living around the same area.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so his wife then with the kid, she goes off and she gets married, I think it's 8 more times.
Wow.
And she lives everywhere from Missouri, Dakota Territory, Montana, Arizona, and lives in Honolulu, Hawaii for a while.
Okay.
Now, when you figure that she was, you know, this is from 1870 to 1910, well, she, her husband, well, he dies, and the son could inherit the farm or the ranch, whatever it was, but he couldn't do that because he'd been married 4 times and only got divorced twice, and that's a felony, and he served time. And her father had about 3 or 4 wives, and he was married to a couple of them, but she had connections, so she pulled and milked her connections, and she got a presidential pardon for her son. Wow. So he could inherit the ranch.
Wow, that's great.
You can't write this crap.
Yeah, I know you can't. I know. Sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction. All right, Todd Roberts has the final question for you, and
this is the most important question of the show.
Indeed, let her rip, Todd.
Okay, Bob, here it is. No pressure, but there's plenty. So. I hope you're sitting down.
Yep.
Your favorite TV or film Western?
Favorite TV or film Western?
I always like Paladin.
Ah.
Oh, good choice.
Oh, wow.
That's a good one.
Have gun, will travel.
Yep.
My goodness.
Mr. Paladine. The episode Ken Curtis was on.
Do we have time for one more question?
Actually, you don't.
Oh, okay. That's a shame because I wanted to know about the S.D. Stevens bottle opener.
All right. If you can do that quickly, Bob, go for it.
A bottle opener?
S.D. Stevens bottle opener?
Well, I've been a bottle collector, and the one way you get a lot of bottles is you dig in the old privy basements.
Yep.
And I've done 200 of those, and we found stuff everywhere from pieces of pistols that Ma threw away so Pa couldn't get in trouble. And we've had, you know, vases that mother-in-law gave to the wife, and she didn't like the mother-in-law, and I went down in the pooper. And you can't imagine what you find down there.
Mm. Oh, boy, oh, boy. Bob Colby, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Most informative and a pleasure to speak with you, sir.
This is more fun than pulling the wings off flies.
There you go. Bunkers is more fun than a sack full of squirrels.
Yeah.
You know, so there we go. We love it. Bob, thank you so much. That's it for this edition of Amo Franzi's Voices of the West.
78, 79, 80 O's. And don't point that camera at me, dang it.
So long, folks.
Thanks for listening to Emil Franzink's Voices of the West.